So there's actually an account of one practitioner, and this person, there's one person who is sitting and assuming to be meditating on patience, and there's one person who is just going around that place and asked, "Oh, what are you doing?" And this person who was sitting said that, "Oh, I'm practicing patience." And the person who is standing and going around, he was quite intelligent, and then said that, "Oh, if you're really practicing patience, so please eat this shit." And then this person became so frustrated and replied, or kind of content by saying that, "You eat it." So actually, this indicates that he's not practicing patience. So as such, the great masters, they would constantly say that, if you don't do the practice well, it would be like assuming an aspect of sanctity, aspect of a religious person, when there's good sunshine, and when you have enough to eat. And whereas when you encounter a very adverse situation, then you really go outrageous, and then you really display your own kind of the aspect of ordinariness. So, and whereas if you can really do a practice so genuine, which can be a guarantee for the next life and so forth, so there then, even at times of adverse conditions, you can actually have the capacity to transform those adverse conditions into path. So, Geshe Chagawa, one of the Kadamba masters, he said that, so while I'm practicing, I've been actually relinquishing all those personal benefits of this life. And then now, at the time of death, I'm really kind of confident, I'm really kind of guaranteed of my next life. He said that. So, when we speak about practicing Dharma, it is not just sufficient to realize something, to gain the understanding of something which you are ignorant of in the earlier times. Rather, whatever you have learned, whatever kind of wisdom that you have derived, you should be able to integrate that to transform, bring about transformation of your mind. So, the kind of Dharma that we are to do should be something which has the capacity to really take everything so easily and take everything into a path. Whatever situation, whatever condition you may be trapped in, you may encounter. So, if you do that, then even at times of adversity, so there would be no condition which can really instill in you a sense of pain, a sense of grievance, and so forth. Rather, one can really handle everything so confidently and so peacefully. And out of these practices, the practice of bodhicitta is in fact the one which is unreliable guide, unreliable friend of yours, and unreliable protector. So, whatever situation that you may encounter through meditation on bodhicitta, the awakening mind, the desire to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, if you can really cultivate such a powerful altruistic intention, then definitely you would have the capacity to transform all adverse situation into the path. And you can be always confident, always be under security of mind. And the great numbers of Buddhas, so it is said that they have reflected for countless numbers of eons, and then realized eventually that it is the bodhicitta which is the essence, which is the quintessential of the entire Buddhist teachings. So, then in order to generate such a powerful intention of the altruism, priorly you have to think of the impermanence of death and so forth. But when we say that, when we speak about the meditation, the impermanence of death, it doesn't mean that you should really forget about the entire life. So for those people, Tavin is here, saying that, oh, now I'm reflecting on the impermanence of death, and so we don't know whether I can have time for going back to returning to Taiwan. And then you try to just give up, discard your ticket, flight ticket and so forth. So this doesn't make any sense. So once the Mao Zedong, he said that religion is actually poison. And he gave two reasons. First, he said that it is because the practice of religion actually hinders the improvement of the civilization or progress of the civilization. And second reason he said is that because of the religion, then there would be no more number of the monks and nuns, thereby hindering the growth of population. And whereas nowadays actually the China is actually in need of this to stop the growth of population. And whereas the actual meditation on impermanence should be such that it should really hinder the progress of the self in terms of this life, and should not have any impact on the progress of the community as a whole. And whereas in terms of the community job, like establishing monasteries, establishing schools, establishing hospitals and so forth, so indeed, in fact, the meditation impermanence and so forth should be actually promoting, enhancing these intentions, the desires to work for the welfare of others. So, for example, if you think of Tomdun Gyewe Jungne, one of the great masters and the principal disciple of Lama Tsongkhapa, principal disciple of Atisha, so it so happened that although his reflection on impermanence and so forth is so powerful and so immediate, and yet he has actually engaged himself in working towards the welfare for other beings by establishing various monasteries and so forth. And Lama Tsongkhapa, if you take him into consideration, and he also is a great master, reflecting constantly on impermanence and so forth, and yet he didn't say that, oh, everything is impermanent and there is no need to establish monasteries and so forth. So rather, he actually established the enormous tradition of Gelug and the Gandhid Monastery. And the first Dalai Lama, so he also, great master himself, and so he was actually very much reflecting on impermanence, and yet also actively participating in towards the welfare of other beings by really trying to inspect the construction of Tashinambu Monastery, instructing each of these people as to what to do, as to, how to really construct the monastery, what kind of paintings to paint, and so forth. So as such, by really trying to look at the biographies of these different scholars and saints, we see that the reflection or the meditation on impermanence should have the capacity to reduce one's own interest of this life, and should have the capacity to promote the interest of the larger group. And as such, it is just the opposite thing that is happening with some of the lamas and some of the teachers. So while they are on the throne of the teaching throne, they will teach about impermanence and these things, saying that, oh, everything is impermanent. And yet, in actuality, in actual life, they would be busy kind of accumulating wealth and wealth and so forth for themselves. So this is actually a great contradiction. So actually, as I said earlier, the meditation on impermanence should be something that should really reduce your self-interest and should have the capacity to promote the welfare of other beings. So with this, we've done with the meditation and impermanence of death, and then reflecting on the generating the desire for to engage in the courses of virtues which would be benefit for the next lives, the coming lives. So this the process of death is actually something that one really need to reflect on, think upon. If you do that in a very in a regular basis, so then definitely it would have tremendous impact on oneself in a very positive way. Because if you do the other way, if you don't try to reflect on these kind of issues like impermanence of death and so forth, so and then you consider it as if like, oh, it is not is so terrifying to reflect on these things, then there is no way by which you can ward off this death. As such, when this actual death comes on you, so that would be just so overwhelming and disturbing to you. So, and whereas if you try to familiarize yourself to this concept of the process of death on a regular basis, so when the actual time of death befalls on you, so you're already being prepared for the next life, and as such, this sense of this overwhelming experiences will not actually overtake you. Explanation of what will become of you in future worlds after death. So it has been kind of exploration that has been undertaken for a few thousands of years. And there's one section of the tradition, religious tradition, we said that the mind is something which is entirely dependent on the physical body, and whenever this physical body ceases, the mind as well ceases. This means at the time of death, the mind will cease altogether and it will have no continuation to the next life. And whereas there is another category of tradition, religious tradition, which says that after the death, the mind will not take a kind of rebirth, next life, but rather it will be either confined to the state of the hell realm or in the heavenly realm. So now His Holiness warned us, what would be the kind of the position of the ancient Chinese? What happens to the mind of those ancestors who passed away many, many, many years ago? So because there's a kind of tradition in Chinese where those people who are alive, they tend to venerate, they tend to make offerings by citing the names of the ancient ancestors. So because there is the old tradition of Chinese before the advent of Buddhism in China, so where you tend to venerate, you tend to worship, citing the names of the ancestors. So what do the Chinese believe in that way? What is believed in terms of the mind of those ancestors? So His Holiness is wondering, how long the ancestors, the object of the mind of that ancestors will last? And then the answer that they give is that the belief is that those minds are kind of eternal. So there are two groups in the same kind of tradition. Some saying that the mind is eternally remaining in that very place, and some believing that the mind would take next birth. So whatever is the case, so they are, on top of Buddhism, there are other non-Buddhist traditions also who believe that who believe in the concept of rebirth. And those category of the non-Buddhists who accept this concept of rebirth, so they say that there is actually a self which is independent of the aggregates and which is actually responsible in taking a new body and discarding the old body and so forth. And whereas Buddhism, the way of accepting the process of rebirth is something very different from theirs, because Buddhism accepts the idea of mere designation. So instead of really pointing to something as a self, it points to a mere designation, a self which is designated upon the five aggregates. So the self is rather a mere designation on the continuum of the mind, the continuum of the aggregates. So as such, from Buddhist perspective, the self is something, a self of a person is something which is designated on the basis of those aggregates of the human being, the continuum of the aggregates of the human being, that the self is designated.